and celebration of the recent debut of my first book, Teaching from the Heart, Lessons on Developing Character, Confidence, and Leadership as a Yoga Teacher. I am excited to share with you a collection of special guest episodes. Be sure to click the follow button so that you are alerted and aware of these special episode releases on the Beyond Yoga Teacher Training podcast. And check out the show notes and be sure to sign up for the Beyond Yoga Teacher Training newsletter so that you can be aware of all the special announcements and giveaways that are coming. Thank you for being a part of the celebration. Now let's get into this special conversation today. Welcome to the Beyond Yoga Teacher Training Podcast, the podcast for yoga teachers to learn tips, techniques, and teaching approaches in order to build confidence and success teaching yoga. I am your host, Sandy Raper, and on this podcast, I am going to share with you my strategies and approach to teaching, along with stories from many teaching experiences that have supported me within a thriving teaching career for over two decades. Hi, Mary. Welcome back to the Beyond Yoga Teacher Training Podcast. Gosh, it was November 2021 when we last spoke and shared an episode together. So can't believe it's been that long. A lot has transpired since then for you, for me, and just like everybody else. And so I'm excited to talk with you again today. And want to welcome you back. One thing in particular, or big thing in particular, and I have it here, is your new book. So I'm excited, yes, for you to speak to that, the inspiration behind it, because this topic, teaching people, not poses, when I hear that, you immediately are who I remember that phrasing, that concept, and it's totally changed my teaching methodology. So we're going to kind of get into that. And let's just kind of start with you sharing about some of the inspiration behind that. And maybe in particular, talk about the curiosity piece, because the very first, it's the very first chapter is called Yoga Curious. So share with us kind of where that, all of that and that inspiration came from.
Well, first, Sandy, thank you so much for having me back. I'm just thrilled to be speaking with you again. And I am delighted to talk about this subject, especially in the context of my book, which was really a project of the heart and was inspired by my dear friend, teacher, and mentor, Judith Hanson Lassiter. Judith wrote the foreword for my book. And Teach People Not Poses is something that I have heard her say for decades. I've been training with Judith literally for decades. And she really helped me reframe how I perceived my role as a yoga teacher and how I think about, to this day, how I think about asana and pranayama. Mm-hmm. Which are kind of the low-hanging fruits, if you will, of teaching yoga.
Right.
And so when I first started teaching almost 25 years ago, I was very rules-driven and system-driven. I started out apprenticing with an Iyengar instructor. And it was very much the way she trained me was very much you say what I tell you to say. And what I found early on, both in my personal practice, which I've been practicing for over 30 years now, mm-hmm. what I found rather early on was a lot of what I was hearing and my understanding of it was not congruent with my lived experiences on the mat. In particular, a lot of the instructions about how to position ourselves in many different asana. I was an NCAA athlete, and I threw shot put, discus, javelin, hammer, and then in the off season, the track off season, I played rugby. And I'd always been a sport, you know. As a little kid, I was I swam for 16 years, and I was a gymnast and played basketball and all of these other things. And so I had a lot of movement instruction in the context of athletics. And then I come to the yoga mat, and so much of what I was hearing, it was the first time I had ever heard things like taking your arms overhead and externally rotating your upper arm bones ad infinitum while pulling your shoulder blades or holding your shoulder blades down on your mat. And I was like, this makes zero sense to me kinesiologically, experientially, but I often abandoned my own inner wisdom because I was receiving this information. I was hearing this information from folks that were a lot older than I was, with a lot more experience. And I had this belief that surely I was in the wrong because I was just a stupid young person who, you know, I looked up to these folks and I wasn't seeing myself reflected in them.
Wow.
And Judith was really my first teacher that co-created with me the conditions where I was able to see myself. And that opened up a much larger world for me. My universe expanded almost overnight. And what I began to cherish and to cultivate within myself and hopefully within the folks who come to me for information to support their practice and teaching is that talk to people, be curious about their experience rather than approaching practice and teaching from a perspective of being, air quotes, right. Approach the practice in a way that you create space for folks to have their own experience.
Yeah. So in your book, there's a part too, I think in that first chapter where it talks about becoming yoga ready. So kind of adding that to, I love that you share your experiential piece of your coming, right? So you came in. So how long were you practicing in that initial phase or whatever we want to call it when you started the practice? How long were you kind of in that? And did the yoga ready, right, kind of expand on that concept of, I think about being ready, being prepared, you know, so kind of help me understand and us understand that yoga readiness and kind of where did that show up for you?
Well, I've been a practitioner for about 8 or 9 years.
When you said that was in the Iyengar, correct?
Yes, yes. And like my teacher at the time, she's deceased now. She died several years ago, but she went to India with Judith. She's actually the one who connected me with Judith back in 2002. So I had been a practitioner for, several years, and I never had any intention to teach, mm-hmm. ever. Who was I to do this? And I had babies at home, and I had what I called a real job. I was like, a real job. Class to take a break from all the responsibilities in my life. And then lo and behold, I take on this mantle of perhaps the greatest responsibility in my life, which is to, you know, create and hold the space with people for them to explore their own path of yoga, which, as we know, as practitioners, is an eightfold path toward enlightenment and spiritual liberation. So, you know, that takes a level of courage that I didn't know I had. And often questioned within myself to this day.
Right.
You know, because there's certainly an aspect of faith to the practice, but faith itself, its expression takes a lot of courage.
Yeah.
And that's why I think I practice so much from my heart. Because what I've learned is it's not my ability to do 108 sun salutations that is the source of my strength. It's my ability to feel. And so I have, you know, I had a lot of asana and pranayama experience, relatively speaking, mm-hmm. when I began apprenticing as a yoga teacher. And that helped me so much, because if there's one thing I can say that supports my teaching more than anything, is practice every day.
Yes.
You have to practice every day. And the way that I became ready for yoga, I was already physically ready, if you will. I was already strong, flexible, and determined. Mm-hmm. I had read the Bhagavad Gita and other sacred texts. So I even had some philosophy in my backpack. But what really I found enables my readiness is to step on my mat every day and to not have any expectation for what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's really easy, I think, to step on your mat, at least it has been for me, is step on my mat and say, okay, I'm going to do 5 Surya A's followed by 5 Surya B's, and then I'm going to do these standing postures. And I've let go of all of that. Now, when I step on my mat, I recognize that I'm the conduit. I'm a conduit through which practice will arise. Mm-hmm. And so I no longer sequence things, you know, because I've got all this experience under my belt.
Right. Well, and
so I really allow my felt senses to enable the decisions I make on that.
Well, and I hear that word, the feeling, the felt experience, and the meeting yourself, so to speak, every day, and the experience without an attachment to some desired, perceived, whatever, usually it's limiting result. And tapping into the felt experience that is for you, but in essence, the beauty it inspires and infuses into being a teacher of the practice as well. I think sometimes if we're going to kind of, maybe we talk a little bit about teachers and teacher trainings and two different skill sets. You know, I mean, you can speak to that, like practicing yoga and teaching yoga is two different things. And the distinction, I believe, that I know, like I just said, that my personal practice time will infuse and be the essence of me as a teacher. But my personal practice time is my gift to myself. And trying to be the student and not on my mat to be, let me create the next class, let me create the next sequence. So it's kind of like, can you really separate the two? But in a way, I have to intentionally, you know, prepare just myself as the student And then the other preparation as a teacher, you know, I think teachers in general sometimes have to be cautious because they start the preparation and rolling through the sequences and creating that, it diminishes their personal encounter with yoga, which is really where I believe the longevity and the ability to teach and hold the space that you're talking about for others to find their yoga. It can be tricky. And I'm thinking about yoga teacher trainings, and I lead those, and I lead them in a way that is trying to set teachers up to eventually be able to hold the space like that. But I think about most teacher trainings that I bear witness to or have been a part of or have the byproduct of some of them coming to me in mentorship to kind of work through some of these things because it wasn't happening in the training. And there's kind of this rigidity and this routine and cueing and sequencing, and it gets real set that how do teachers develop to that felt sense holding that space for students. And I know that's a big topic, but how do we kind of ready ourselves to, if a teacher's watching this and it desires to get to that space, I mean, gosh, where is even the start point of getting to that? Because you think about initially stepping out to lead a class and all the things that go on. Like, where do we start, Mary, to get teachers developing towards that teaching methodology?
So I have a different perception, if you will, yeah, about the relationship between practice and teaching.
Okay, yeah.
While I certainly practice for myself, you know, when I get on the mat, perhaps my reconstructed left knee is cranky because I've been hiking on really hard terrain or for longer distances than my knee enjoyed. So I might have some sort of physical concern that I'd like to interact with on the mat, or I might have something going on in my family that I need to interact with. But I actually think of my practice as service to my students. Mm-hmm. I practice for the students and I teach for myself.
Oh, I like that.
So it's not uncommon for me when I get on the mat, especially because I've got a replaced hip. I've got a reconstructed knee. Mm-hmm. I've had an organ system removed. I've had a lot of stuff in my life, in my physical health. You know, I just had cardiac ablation in October. Like, I joke that someday I'm just going to be a head in a jar sitting on a shelf, you know, and talking. And so I think, so I've got all this physical stuff, and, you know, I'm 54 years old, and I'm a parent, and I've lived a lot of life. I've had a lot of stuff happen, as so many of us do, if we're fortunate to age. And so I find that when I practice, I'm often thinking about my students, mm-hmm, not like, oh, I saw so-and-so on the mat the other day and they have SI joint dysfunction, so I'm going to do a whole SI joint series. It's not that explicit. Mm-hmm. But what I found is that just organically for me, when I'm on the mat, I'm just thinking about all of the lovely folks who have come to me and trusted me to share information that they may enjoy. And so organically for me, my practice becomes an act of service, mm-hmm, to the teacher. And then when I teach, that's my opportunity to share my ideas and to offer folks different opportunities to experience asana and pranayama in a manner they may not have the faith to try on their own.
Right.
And when I first started teaching so many years ago, I used to have index cards with like the perfect bell curve series. And I would have it at the front corner of my mat. And I was so well prepared because I had this idea that I was in some way performing for the students. Mm. And what I found, honestly, the first class that I taught, what I found was I taught maybe 30% of what was on that card, because what was on that card wasn't what was in the room.
Right.
And so teaching then for me, and this happens increasingly, is it's a true give and take of what's alive in the room with me, within the people in front of me. And that's why I'm so curious about kinesiology, how bodies move in the context of gravity, and why I love anatomy so much, because the more fluent I become in the science of movement and structure, the more tools I have in my kit to offer individualized information to the people in front of me. And that doesn't mean that I'm going around in the room necessarily and saying, you do this, you do that, I'd like you to try this. It's not like that. It's that I'm able to recognize with greater subtlety the trends in the group, and to say, so for those of you experiencing this in your front knee, I'd like you to try positioning your foot this way. Because what I found is what may serve one person in Virabhadrasana 2 will often serve many. Mm-hmm. So I'm no longer teaching the poses as they appear in, say, Light on Yoga, which most of us have. It's a great book. I love that book. Mine is so well loved. It's literally held together with rubber bands. But I'm no longer teaching Virabhadrasana 2 so much as I'm looking for the Virabhadrasana 2 to reveal itself from within the students.
Right.
And I found that that looks different for everyone.
Yes. Yeah.
And
so for a teacher, gosh, this is so rich. And so I think there's just some layers of subtlety that, like, I'm trying to think about, you know, how to maybe make this in some pieces tangible of, you know, I love the perspective of, you are practicing in your home practice, you know, for your students, you're teaching for yourself. So I want to get into that, maybe expand it, of understanding teachers preparing to be able to go into this space. And like you said, see the individuals and allow the pose to express themselves. Cause this is probably going to be, for some, this may be a whole, like, mind-blowing teaching methodology of understanding, because I believe that approach becomes very student-centered, that then allows us to expand and create some longevity doing this work. Because it's I call it the most worthy endeavor, and kind of overwhelming, of, like you said earlier on, I'm like, who am I? Right. And, you know, but then step in with courage to hold this space for people to find this. So it I don't want to, maybe diminish is not the word, but it kind of changes what I think some teachers get, these little tools, right, in their teacher training, and they think that's all they need. And they go out, and then all of a sudden they're like, yeah, this sequence doesn't match this person that came in. And this is we're teaching humans. It's relational, right? It's technical. There's a technique, but there's a relational aspect. Yeah. So how do teachers get away from kind of rigidity of things they say that's trying to get them in the shape of Warrior Two instead of it manifesting itself?
Yeah.
That was probably a big question.
Well, you know what, though? I love thinking about this because a lot of us, when we first step on the mat, our students, the folks who come to us to connect through practice, they have an idea. And I know I believed this for a very long time when I first started practicing, is I don't know these poses. I don't know these poses. What is this Virabhadrasana 2? Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. We know how to hinge, Uttanasana. We know how to lunge, Vira 1, Vira 2, Anjaneyasana. We know how to squat, Utkatasana, Malasana. Mm-hmm. We have these bija, these seeds of movement within mm-hmm. us. Our bodies actually already know the asana. Mm-hmm. I believe that our most important role, our most important responsibility, it transcends the word role, our sacred duty as yoga teachers is to get out of the way. Yes. And allow the asana to emerge from the space within the student. So we can say, okay, now we're going to do this open lunge position known as Warrior Two. And we may demonstrate it. And then we can offer information. Okay, so if you're knock knee, if your knees tend to trend toward the midline of your body, I'd like you to press your knee out toward the little toe side of your foot so that your kneecap is centered between your second and third toes. We may say, I'd like you to press your back thigh bone strongly toward the wall behind you. We can offer those instructions in a way that will help our students find the asana within themselves. Mm-hmm. This is why I think of asana as like going on a hike or an adventure, because it's not, the asana is a destination, but it's the journey that is the learning. Mm-hmm. And so it's important as teachers that we have an idea, that we know how to get to the destination. We know where it is on the map, and we have ideas about where we're going to take rest stops, where we're going to spend a little bit more time. How we're going to navigate our way there. We absolutely need those skills. Mm-hmm. We also, though, need to have more trust in ourselves, in our students, where we get out of their way. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, if we're looking at a potentially injurious situation, we need to intervene, but I think that we tend to over-instruct. Mm-hmm. And we do that, I think, not so much because it serves our students so much as it reduces our anxiety.
Yes. Yes.
So
what about the teacher then and the courage to step in and the willingness to see a vast landscape of various expressions of Warrior Two, or what, like the willingness to not try to put everybody in the same position. And I think that's
right.
A lot are trying to do that, and it's going against kind of this allowing space of letting the unfolding take place. But it's kind of like you have to, in your mind, get to the point of being okay with that taking place across the classroom instead of trying to put everybody in the same to look the same. Because that's how unrealistic is that?
Well, see, here's the thing. Everybody's unique, just like everyone else. Right. So Warrior Two is going to look different in every single person in the class. And it's important to celebrate the diversity of it. Mm-hmm. And what I think then, this is where anatomy and kinesiology is so helpful, because what we're looking at then is, does the shape fit the person? Mm-hmm. It's because when we're seeking everyone to look the same, if you will, or similar enough, we're then imposing the shape over the person. Mm-hmm. And I believe what we want to do is we want to encourage the shape to emerge from within.
Right.
And I remember many years ago, I was in, this was back in 2008 or 2009, and I was in a teacher untraining, was literally the name of the week-long workshop, teacher untraining with Angela Farmer and 55 Cooper. Mm-hmm. And they were teaching downward facing dog, Adho Mukha Svanasana. And it was like this wiggly, tail wagging version of Adho Mukha. And I said to a dear friend of mine who was sitting next to me, we were of course front row center. And I looked at my friend and I said, I don't think we're allowed to do that. We're not yoga practitioners. And I mean, I whispered at Sandy, like, I am capable of whispering. And Angela was many feet away from me. And she turned and looked at me and she pointed at me and she went, you.
Oh.
And there was a stage in the room and she called me up on the stage and I was like, oh, no. And I, to this day, I still don't remember, you know, I couldn't tell you the narrative of what happened on that stage, but I remember what it felt like. They took my dog off the leash, and I went from this really restrained, precise, downward facing dog, and somehow ended up in Pinchamayarasana in the forearm balance. I don't know how that happened, but all I know is that afterwards I felt so grounded and connected to myself. And later in that week, I was having a face-to-face conversation with Angela Farmer. And we had been doing Bhujangasana, the cobra pose. And she'd been saying to me, allow your hood, your cobra hood, to emerge from the space between your shoulder blades and to flare up and around you. And I let that happen. And we all felt it, like it was this palpable shift in energy in the pose. And so we were talking and I said, you know, I've always had this idea that the asana are these idealized forms that are, you know, miles above me, and I'm down here on the earth, and I'm not worthy enough to express them. And Angela said to me, I know exactly what that feels like, and it's a very bankrupt way to practice. Because I was practicing in pursuit of the asana, that they somehow lived not only outside of me, but were superior to me and lived above me. And what Angela really helped me understand in my interstitial space, you know, the space between my cells, like on an atomic level even, was that, no, wait, the asana is this archetypal language, and it's my brain, it's my prefrontal cortex, and all of the judgments and decisions that I'm making that are separating me from the asana. And that allowed me as a teacher. Now, mind you, I had been teaching at that point for almost 10 years. Okay, so this was a lot. This lesson is still unfolding. This learning still unfolds in me, even with all of my experience as a teacher. It gave me permission to be less predictable and to seek less predictability, and instead to not manage my own imposter syndrome and self-judgment and anxiety by creating consistency or similarity in the room, but instead to look around and say, oh, that person, they're really enjoying their warrior too. It's really different from that person's, and that person who's doing the textbook Warrior Two, they don't seem to be having as much satisfaction, experiencing as much satisfaction or some closure, contentment in the pose. So what can I do that may introduce an element of ease for them? So often the instructional cues that we share are perhaps subliminally motivated by the belief that predictability and control equals safety.
Now let's, yeah, a little bit of, so all of that and talking about instructions and cueing, like how then do we change the narrative? To me, and all your, what I hear too, and at a process I'm in too, is kind of this unlearning, right? You, all these stuff, you like, you step back and now you start to unlearn some things of what we thought was so like, this is the way you're going to do it. How do we as teachers start to change our narrative that becomes an invitation then for people to step out of predictability, step out of attainment? Because I've had in the past, somebody came to me and was like, now how many yoga poses are there? Like they were ready. They were trying to check, you know? And I said, oh, I can't answer that. You know, like we're trying to attain this. And when we, you know, get to this, we've arrived. And so if we shift that and think about the asanas, and I love you said earlier, like I think of them like little vehicles, and I'm like a tour guide, you know, we're going through, and you know, you might get off the tour, you know, you might explore. And how do we start to use our language or to support the space that people begin to feel comfortable in the space of curiosity and variety as opposed to predictability and thinking they need to fit into something? How do we change, like as teachers, is there some kind of, you know, is it an evolving, like a process? Of course, I believe it is. But is there anything like a start point? How can we change that?
Well, this is so exciting. I feel like we could talk about this for a minute.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. So I'm like, oh, how do I edit this question to be? This is very.
Yeah, it is a process, absolutely. But here's the thing, like, this is why it's so important that we get on our mats and practice mm-hmm. and do different things on our mats. Yeah. We change up the order in which we do things. We experiment with different foot positions, with the base and the like when we're doing standing poses. We play with our bodies. Like, we introduce an element of play, because then when we are at the front of the classroom, we can bring that sense of play and that love of play to the class. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be, in my opinion, informed by anatomy and kinesiology, because the more we are able to see bony landmarks, mm-hmm. our skeletal topography, mm-hmm. the more options we have to offer people, to invite them to find, to release their inner warriors. So it's really easy to conflate soft tissue with structure. Now, this doesn't mean soft tissue doesn't have form. Obviously, biceps have form, glutes have form, quads, etc. But the muscles overlay our structure. And the reality is we can never escape our skeletal proportions. We can never escape our joint configurations, if you will. So that's why it's so important as teachers, we learn to recognize greater trochanters, anterior superior iliac spines, C7, T1, T12, L1, the natural angle of inclination for the sacrum, so that we're not telling people that they have sway backs, when odds are they may just have rounder glutes. Mm. And so the more we are able to recognize structure and form, the more elasticity and receptivity we have to welcome students to express asana for themselves. And the anatomy book, and like, I have a serious anatomy and kinesiology problem. And I'm not interested in getting help for this problem. I'm really nurturing in myself. But like, the thing is, if you look in an anatomy book, whether it's Frank Netter, I've had cadaver lab, all that stuff, all right? So whether you're looking at Netter or you're looking at, say Ray Long's key muscles of Hatha Yoga, these are idealized forms.
Right.
They're meant to give us a point of reference so that we can begin to recognize form. But the way we really learn anatomy is by looking at each person as an individual. And looking at ourselves in the mirror, palpating our own bony landmarks, and then moving. Like the body is, we have built-in cliff notes.
Yes.
You know, we always have a point of reference. And
right.
So that, I think one of the most helpful things I did for myself as a newer yoga teacher was I actually went to the community college and I took human anatomy and physiology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I took patho anatomy and physiology and comparative. And I'm not saying everyone has to do that, but what I am saying is if you're going to teach yoga or Pilates or Tai Chi or any movement system, learn the basics, the essentials of skeletal anatomy, and then movement science, specifically gravity.
Yes, yes. That, I think, Mary, is what I see kind of lacking in foundational 200-hour trainings. And that's why teachers roll out of those and are not confident, I believe. They're not confident in a system and a structure. And they're trying to go out and lead a movement modality and try to see something. I don't know that they're seeing, number one, because they're trying to maybe memorize and recite and go through a routine. And I just don't know how long you can sustain that.
Yeah, and so much anatomy instruction is boring.
Right.
Like, okay, where's the, greater trochanter? Where's the lateral malleolus, the medial femoral condyle? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, what does that information does you no good if you don't then understand anatomical variation and how that relates to instructional requests?
Yes.
Like the reason why you need to know where someone's tibial tuberosity and ASIF is because that tells you the degree to which the person may or may not be knock-kneed or bow-legged. Mm-hmm. And that's going to determine how you offer foot placement in various poses.
Right, right.
And so like when I was co-directing a teacher training program, I would teach palpation with consent so folks could, and in groups, like find the iliac crest. And
right.
Why do you need to know that? Because in mountain pose, you may notice that one person's hip is higher than the other. So what needs to change about their foot position to balance out the torso? And then I would teach planes of movement in the light and joint movements in twister. We would play Twister.
Nice.
And that was super fun for me.
Right.
Because here's the thing, it put movement in the context. It put planes of movement and joint movements in the context of actually moving.
Right.
And folks got it.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I and then they were like, oh, this makes so much more sense now.
Right. And it becomes relevant. And I heard earlier that a functional piece, right? Some of these, like you even said before, not even calling them the yoga pose names that we associate, but it's functional movements we find we hopefully are doing during our days or seeking to do that will then we're in a practice too that has all the other layers of yoga and why we practice, but creates this relevance. And for me, in my experience, when something's relevant, I will do it more and incorporate that into the ability of it's not a must. It's a, this is what I do. And then thinking about holding the space for other people to find relevance of, you know, I've kind of been in this pursuit for the last year or so, like, why do people come back to the yoga mat? You know, why are they coming back? And, you know, it's not as crazy, all these tricks and, you know, well, it might be some, but, you know, this choreography and all these things, but, you know, it could be the curiosity and the play if we're bringing in variety of movement and intrigue and that curiosity, but, you know, what is it that's bringing students back to their mat and dedicating to this practice? And for me as a teacher, that's kind of a live into of trying to hold a space that, like you said, I kind of fade in the background, but I'm holding a space of that inquiry and curiosity and safe to explore those things in that setting. And that I'm not trying to put them in something and they're not there to perform for me. You know, they're there and we're having a collective experience together. And so I think what I'm hearing, right, as kind of a, if a yoga teacher is watching this, listening to this, like really dig into the I call it the why behind, right, the movement, like what it is and understand that better, because it's just going to be challenging, I think, to really do this if you don't have a basis of the structure of where it's coming from and all the, you know, like, how do you do this thing? And how do you do it well if you don't have that?
Yeah, because it's the pose isn't the purpose, right?
Yeah. So, oh, that might be a, yeah.
The pose is, it's not about the poses. If I make this riff on what I heard you say, I believe folks come to class because they enjoy the people, they enjoy us as teachers. It may be the one, you know, hour or more in their day where they have room to breathe. And the last thing I believe most of us need is someone telling us what to do again and again and again. And so by offering opportunities for people to find their way through their triangle pose, it reminds them, reconnects them to their autonomy and agency.
Yeah.
And that's satisfying for people. It's not the workout aspects of yoga. Is asana a form of exercise? Absolutely. But it's not the purpose,
right,
or the intention. The intention of the asana is to co-create conditions within ourselves for connection and contentment and presence.
Yeah.
To remind ourselves that we are awareness.
Mm. Yes.
And so if we are really pose focused, I believe we've missed the proverbial point.
Ooh.
And this is coming from someone who back in the day was very pose driven.
Right.
Very pose driven. I did not feel that I had done my so-called job if your mat wasn't drenched.
Mm.
And what I found, what I really enjoy now as a more mature teacher, is I enjoy the laughter in class and the, honestly, the volunteers in class.
Which
are not because someone's gotten hurt. It's because they've connected to their heart in a way that it can't be contained anymore, and it just has to leak out of their eyes.
So,
this is the thing. We come to class for the social engagement of it, the community of it. And that's why, even though overwhelmingly my practice is in the privacy of my lair here, my yoga lair, I really encourage, I love to teach group classes, and I encourage people to go to class because it's so empowering to be in a group of people who are coming to the mat together, no matter what our motivations are, but that we have made the choice to come together to connect through the modalities of yoga.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, service and connection are my two driving, that's why I teach, and everything, you know, I consider and do are falling under that. And in the pursuits of development as an individual, as a teacher, is technical, but the relational and connecting and coming together for a moment in time, you know, sweet moments, tearful moments, whatever they are, humanity coming together, because we're not teaching a bunch of robots. And so it's kind of pull away from the rigidity of trying to put everybody in this box and really open up to some freedom of an encounter that just makes this vocation of teaching just, that's why it's been over two decades for me. And for, you know, and that's where I, as a teacher, I'm sure you feel as a teacher, and trying to encourage others is to get into this space and this relational heart space, and we're using, you know, and get educated in your skill set, but in a way that supports people to come into this co-creation of an experience together. So Mary, look, this could be like, I could talk to you for hours, and I was so excited to get to chat with you again. But before we kind of wrap up, so this book, right, inspiration and kind of your purpose coming out, like, you know, what do you feel like when this was birthed? I kind of liken it to being a birthing project, a child, but an inspiration for yoga practitioners, for a resource for yoga teachers, like kind of for you, your desire for this. You know, tell us a little bit about that. And then are there other ways that people can connect with you? I'd love for, you know, listeners to know how to connect further with you and what you have going on.
Yeah, so I think I write this in the book that I really intended teach people not poses to be like a big tent event that really welcomes everyone onto the mat on their own terms, in their own anatomy, to really connect to how we are embodied, to move away from the marketing and the commercialization of our bodies, and to look at ourselves in the mirror, or to get together and have a bony a body mapping play date with people, so that we really reconnect for most of us and remember that it's miraculous the way that we are constructed. Our architecture, our structure, the unity of form and function, and that comes together to provide this locus for our consciousness is truly miraculous and awesome. And I don't mean that, you know, in the Valley Girl 1980s way, but truly awesome. And so I believe that I want to live in a world, where more of us remember that we are home within ourselves every day. And the book was really an offering from my perspective of the things that I've done for decades now to remember myself. And so to get to know our bodies, that's why I didn't use photographs. My wonderful graphic designer, Lily Robbins, I asked her to do line drawings because I want us to think outside the, you know, the social media and stuff like that. And really, what does the head of my humerus feel like under the acromion? I think that because that, I feel these things when I'm practicing asana or when I'm carrying groceries or I'm picking up my child or walking my dog. And also to remember that there's value in our individuality. Our individuality, our integrity, our autonomy, our agency, our independence. These are the seeds from which liberation grows. And I want us to have fun too on the mat. And I want us to feel safe on the mat and off the mat for that matter.
Right.
And so that's really what led me to write this book is I'm in so many ways a yoga evangelist. I'm taking that term back because I know how much the practice has helped me.
Right.
And if it can help me, it can help others.
Yeah. Yeah. I often tell people I'm a huge advocate for yoga.
I'm a huge advocate.
Yeah. I appreciate you sharing this and sharing yourself, your story. And it is inspiring and encouraging and you know, it takes a lot of vulnerability to put yourself in this form. There's a kind of a finality to it, an evergreen. Certainly you can revise things, but when you put it in print and you put it out there, and so that's a an extension of your heart coming out to share and a passion to because you know what it's done for you, right? And you seek that for others.
And it really is like publishing a book really is like having another child. And I'm fortunate that I have two children. And it's your heart walking around on the planet.
Right.
And it was, you know, it took a leap of faith. I'm not shy about my opinions or my perspectives. But there's something about the being able to physically pick up a copy of your words.
Right. Right.
That it's like, whoa, this now has a body to it.
Right.
And bodies can be vulnerable.
Yes, yes.
But I really am thrilled that I had the opportunity because, and it's funny because, you know, there's a lot in the book. You know, this isn't a book that you just sort of sit and read.
Right, right.
Because I really, again, I want us to bring the anatomy and the science of the movement and the philosophy behind asana practice into the living moment. Mm-hmm. Because in my ideal world, we're all able to feel comfortable and steady in our bodies, mm-hmm. Yeah. Or to return to a state of steadiness and comfort when we feel dislodged from that. And right. So I try to offer a lot of strategies to do that throughout the book.
Yeah. And it's a great resource. And I love, it's a reference, like come back to, and I'm a highlighter person. So from the very beginning, it was like, oh, this highlighter's going to go to work. But yeah, and just to come back to, and I think you touched on a little bit, you know, that's a lot of this, I think, practice and this reminding and remembering and then understanding capacity. And we remember again, and we've got the capacity to explore again, to whatever's going on, we have a, you know, I think it's a great resource. So thank you for gifting that. I've been in a process and I'm kind of in that. So I understand in a different way, that putting that out there. And so, I appreciate you doing that. And is there anything else, as we wrap up that you're about, that's going on, that's, even any way that people can connect with you and your teaching or in person? I know you just came off of a wonderful experience with Judith. Anything else in the works?
Yeah, Judith, I'm still a little jet lagged. I'm not gonna lie. I just got home late Monday night from Mount Madonna Center with Judith, where we were co-teaching a retreat. I'm teaching Saturday. I do this monthly online offering that I call Asana Lab, and it's 2 hours of not a lot of lecture. I spend about 20 minutes introducing the anatomy and kinesiology that we're going to focus on. But it's my husband is our volunteer, which he's perfect for, because he not only does he not have any yoga experience, he's not even remotely curious. So he's like the perfect person because he's a beginner.
Right.
And so I spend 2 hours online every month. This Saturday is only camels need humps, and it's about thoracic strength and mobilization. You know, I think I'm funny. So I do that every month. And then I'm going to be out at Heaven Meets Earth Yoga in Evanston, Illinois in July for a weekend workshop. And Lizzie, Judith, and I have a couple of online courses this year as well. Mm-hmm. One of them is Somatic Woman Beyond Menopause. Oh. And then the other is this fall, and it's going to be an experiential anatomy course about the low back.
Nice.
So I'm busy. And then I've got other stuff, other irons in the fire too.
Right.
This is like all I think about, honestly.
Right. Well, I'm going to include all that information of how people can connect to you, your website, and more information about you in the notes. But I can relate. You probably wake up and things are going through your mind already. That happens to me. But, you know, what a wonderful pursuit and to be about something that's has great potential to support individuals and others. And, you know, there could be other things we could be consumed with.
It's not that it's the only thing I do, you know, I do other stuff, but right. Always, and this is not an overstatement, unfortunately, maybe I should admit this, but always in the back of my mind is yoga. Always. And so, yeah, and if you go to my website, yogawithmaryrichards.com, you kind of get a sense.
Right. You will see from there. So, well, Mary, hey, it's been a treat. Thank you. I hope maybe it doesn't go as long of a period of time, a stretch of time before we get together again. But thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sandy. It's been really delightful to connect with you again. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's guest episode with Mary Richards as she returned to the Beyond Yoga Teacher Training podcast. What a treat and pleasure to have conversation with Mary and gain new insight each and every time I speak with Mary. I hope you'll check out the show notes and connect with Mary further. Also, be sure to click the follow button so that you will be alerted of these guest episodes that I have planned and are going to be rolling out in the coming weeks in celebration of the release of my debut of my first book, Teaching from the Heart. Until next time, I wish you well along life's journey. Until we meet again, thank you. Thank you for joining me today, and I wish you well along life's journey. And I'll look forward to spending time with you in the next episode.